Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Miller Center non-resident fellow and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm rejoined by my partner in strategery, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Chair of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, world traveler.
Yeah, well, I do feel a little bit like a kind of an itinerant preacher, but it's good to be back for now, although I'll be hitting the road again, and we can talk more about that later. But very interesting trips, kind of depressing, and we probably should talk about the trip and maybe talk a bit about some other exciting things that have been happening in the Middle East as well.
Yes, so plenty to talk about, and you've been in the middle of both arenas here, having been to Ukraine yourself on this trip, and then having written in The Atlantic about the Iranian, fairly large-scale Iranian attack on Israel over the weekend, so we'll get to that. But let's start with kind of getting a trip report for you from Ukraine. I noticed this morning that General Sirski, the commander, was explaining that the battle front is getting much more difficult for the Ukrainians. They're clearly being outgunned at this point by the Russians. The ammunition shortages that are attendant to our lack of military assistance because of the inaction and utter irresponsibility of the Republican conference in the House of Representatives, is taking a toll. But how did it look from on the ground in Kyiv and elsewhere?
Sure. So this was my third trip to Ukraine. I've had two others. Again, this was a small group. I went with some Polish colleagues from their Foreign Affairs Institute, PISM, P-I-S-M. We were accompanied by General Roman Nadrzejczyk, who had been the previous Polish Chief of Defense Staff, our mutual friend Mick Ryan, formerly of the Australian Army, and my colleague here, Seth Jones. So it was a very good group. It was a small group. And I think what we all came away with a somewhat grim view. The Ukrainians will fight. I mean, let's be very clear about that. We'll talk a little bit later on about, notions of them negotiating with the Russians, which are pretty much off, I think. But, you could feel it. So, there's the stuff that's been, everything that's been reported, shell shortages, ratios of fire of 5 to 7 to 1 or even more. There's also their kind of internal wrestling with the problem of mobilization. There's, on top of that, I think the, one big issue that you can see is these people are tired. I mean, they've been waging existential war for 2 years now. And of course, many of them have been thoroughly engaged before. And, one thing, as I'm sure you found on your trips overseas, particularly when you're going to conflict zones, is you start with it, you have a certain kind of emotional baseline that you see with your interlocutors. I mean, I felt this very much, if you remember when I went to Israel, that these folks really felt way off baseline. It's not quite that bad here, but a number of these people I'd met before, and it felt different. I mean, they looked more pressured. I think that, one of the other big things to understand is that the Russians are adapting. The West made this horrific mistake, which I think it's fair to say you and I have bemoaned from the very beginning, of not arming the Ukrainians at the right scale and with the right sense of urgency. Now we're paying for it, because guess what? After 2 years, the Russian army, which has plenty of smart people at its center, even if it's the way it treats its manpower is extraordinarily callous and brutal. They learn, and they are learning, and they're adapting at kind of the operational level. The one thing that became clear on the trip is that the Ukrainian is just how much the Ukrainians tend to innovate from the bottom up. This is a point that Mick made in his excellent Substack and during the trip as well. And, you know, you see that. And they're, you know, they've recovered some of their mojo in terms of electronic warfare. The effect of Chinese more or less non-lethal support is becoming clear. North Korean stuff. Now, there are some bright spots, and I do want to mention those. One is it's clear that Ukrainian technical innovation is still quite remarkable. They have their own drone industry. Of course, they had the biggest part of the Russian aerospace industry before the breakup of the Soviet Union. But it's not just that they're producing, you know, interesting new widgets. They are producing them at scale. And even some of the less exotic things. So they now are producing a bunch of self-propelled howitzers every month, which is something they weren't producing before. So their industry is getting mobilized. It'll be mobilized, I think, outside Ukraine as well as inside it. And they understand that they have to produce at scale. But overall, it's it felt grim. And it felt particularly grim because I have to say, as an American, I just felt ashamed. You know, I just felt deeply ashamed that we were letting these people down because of some stupid, Republic, blind, selfish, uninformed Republican congressman. And it's not a large number, but it's enough to throw things into chaos. I felt terrible being an American overseas, which is a feeling I always hate.
Yeah. What you're saying about Ukrainian innovation is very consistent with what some of my colleagues on the National Defense Strategy Commission, who were in Ukraine at roughly the same time you were, being hosted by the Minister of Strategic Industries.
Yeah, who met with.
They saw a lot of the defense innovation that you were talking about. I think the reason that it's important to maybe dwell on that for a moment, and I'm glad you raised it, is that I think when you talk to critics, right, or like Senator J.D. Vance, who had a op-ed, a pretty egregious one, in the New York Times saying the math doesn't add up. There's no way Ukraine, you know, can win against Russia because it's bigger and it's stronger. I would call it a Marxoid view of the war, which is that because Russia can outstrip Ukraine in terms of manpower, and manpower is a very, very serious problem for the Ukrainians, as you mentioned. I mean, some of the fatigue you're talking about, I think, is because they haven't been able to really rotate troops the way one would like, in part because of manpower shortages, some of which are, you know, I think we have to concede are a bit self-imposed because of the limits on conscription and mobilization. But part of the answer to this sort of notion that the Ukrainians are going to be overwhelmed because the Russians can outproduce them and outman them is that Ukraine is incredibly resilient. It is, you know, very innovative. It does have a lot of productive capacity. And of course, if we harness the collective capacity of all of Ukraine's friends and allies, it vastly outstrips, you know, what the Russians can do. So this, you know, emphasis on Ukrainian indigenous defense production capability and innovation is important because I think it's got to be part of a theory of victory for Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, it's Senator Vance is, when he's not being disingenuous, is guilty not of vulgar Marxism, but of particularly stupid Marxism, because of exactly the point you made about resources. And actually, the Russians are facing challenges. You know, it's not as if there's a whole, production lines are churning out hundreds and hundreds of tanks. They're not. What they're doing is they're drawing down their Cold War stocks, which were vast. They're refurbishing them. That's the kind of stuff they're very good at. You know, you look at say how they maintain the space station with a lot of duct tape and, you know,
bailing wire and
bailing wire. And, you know, we buy fancy pens that can write in space. They just use pencils, but still after a while, they're going to run out of those things, and their own production cannot maintain it. I mean, there's a reason why they have to have Iranian drones and North Korean shells. So they, I mean, the ultimate odds are very much against them. The other thing is, you know, the Brits, I think, were estimating that the Russians are taking on the order of 30,000 casualties a month, which is stunning. Now, they are willing to keep on dipping into their manpower pool, but despite what people say, that's not infinite. And it doesn't, and it's not clear that Russian patience is eternal, particularly on a war that most Russians don't actually think is really a necessary war. And I think, you know, there's this fundamental asymmetry that you're dealing with one society that's open and democratic, and where the press can roam around and report stuff, and another which is really closed and repressive. And so you're not going to see that stuff until something blows up. And then everybody will say, well, we should have seen that coming all along. But of course, we never do. So, you know, I think even in a battle of endurance, the Russians lose, particularly if we do the things that enable the Ukrainians to substitute technology for bodies. But we're not doing that. Now, they're, you know, the good sign is that, bless them, the Czechs and the Estonians have found ways to secure supplies of 155 millimeter shells. But you know, what the Ukrainians really need right now is they need surface to air missiles. That's the kind of crunch thing, because this is the other development which I think is quite concerning. The Russians, after having been really unable to deploy air power in an effective way, have finally figured out how to do it. And what they're doing is they're going after the electrical power grid. And, you know, their basic intention, I think, is even if they feel they can't conquer the whole country, they will try to depopulate cities like Kharkiv by bombarding them. And they will try to make the rest of the state unlivable and a failed state by destroying the power grid. No, I don't think they'll be successful actually in either, but they'll get very close. And it's, again, the thing that is just so distressing is this is utterly, totally unnecessary. And it's reflects a kind of mindless isolationism. And of course, part of this is also just fidelity to Trump. It makes me sick to my stomach to think that the party that I used to belong to has people like that in it.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's very reminiscent too of you know, the same argumentation was made by the America Firsters before World War II. The Allies can't beat Germany. The Germans will outproduce them, and they, you know, will have more manpower than the French and the Brits. And of course, we shouldn't bother aiding them. And of course, you know, the one begets the other, right? If you don't aid them, well, of course, they're going to lose. And it doesn't take into account what the consequences of defeat are, of course, which is the other unspoken part of the argument. I want to come back to the energy grid targeting, the geothermal plants that they're going after, et cetera, in a minute. But before I do, I just wanted to confirm a prior, which is my sense from, you know, observing this from afar, is that although the Russians are replenishing their manpower losses, they're doing it with essentially mass and not quality. It's quantitative, not qualitative, in the sense that they are moving rapidly, you know, mobilized guys, mobics, to the front, but they're not particularly well trained, not particularly well motivated, and as they are taking these terrific, you know, manpower losses, and they're also taking a lot of equipment losses, which even their ramped up defense production, and we should stipulate that they have, you know, ramped up defense production beyond, I think, what our intelligence community initially assessed they could do quickly. They've done that very quickly. But even so, as you say, it only works because it's, you know, being supplied by the Chinese, the Iranians, and others, you know, precision machine-making equipment from China, you know, drones and turnkey drone factories from Iran.
Propellants.
I'm sorry?
Propellants.
Propellants, gun, you know, gun cotton, et cetera. So they can't even, you know, do it on their own. And even with the ramped up production, they still can't actually replace the equipment losses. They're still kind of running behind. Is that a fair characterization of the situation?
I think that's a fair characterization. It shouldn't be entirely surprising. I mean, you cannot, if you're having that level of turnover, then except in quite elite units, you're just not going to have well-trained troops. You know, and I think there's plenty of evidence that, you know, it takes months to, even under the pressures of wartime and all that, it takes months to train soldiers, and you need a kind of a comprehensive system for how you feed them into old units. You know, you pull them out of the line. I mean, the Germans, who took horrific losses in World War II, were very good at this. Pull a division out of the line, fill it with fresh recruits, go through a training cycle, even if it's an abbreviated and intense one, and then put them back in. The one thing, though, that conditions this, I think, is that historically, and I think this remains true today, the Russian military is, you know, tactically has never been particularly proficient, except to some extent on the defense. You know, on the offense, they've always been not a whole lot of subtlety, a lot of frontal assaults, terrible combined arms at the local, at, you know, small unit level, and so on. Where the Russian skill has been at the level of what people call operational art. And that is handling large formations, looking at a whole front and saying, you know, we'll feint here, we'll attack there, incorporating deception and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, you're seeing somewhat more of that. That said, you know, you do have a sense that they're continuing to be extraordinarily reckless in how they spend human lives, and how, which they don't care about, but they're also spending equipment, which they really should care about at some level. And so, you know, it's always, I think in war, it's always either to overestimate or underestimate your enemy. I think we went into this war with a radical overestimate of the Russians. I think a lot of us kind of fell into, and I would probably put myself in this too, somewhat underestimating them. And now I think there's a pendulum swing back, and we may be overestimating them again. So I think that's, I mean, they have recovered in many important ways, but that's it. And, you know, the other thing really important, I think, to remind everybody of is, you know, this is a war of multiple campaigns. And there's the campaign on the different land fronts. There's the naval campaign, which the Russians have been losing big time in the Black Sea. There's the strategic strike campaign, in which they've done particularly well against the electoral system. But then the Ukrainians are having these tremendous successes, well, substantial successes, I should say, against key nodes in the their petrochemical, against their petrochemical industries. I think accepted figure is reducing their output of some of the refineries by about 12%, which is not inconsequential. Of course, needless to say, you know, we then begin criticizing them for this, which, you know,
it's not crazy.
Yeah, it is not as strategically imbecilic and self-destructive as what the hardline Republicans are doing, but it is strategically imbecilic. And maybe you'd like to explain to our listeners why.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've written about this, and actually so have I. Frank Miller and I and John Herbst have a piece that it's about to appear in the Bulwark in the next day or two. So first, you know, this began to, well, let me back up. This started from the get-go with the administration making it clear to the Ukrainians that they did not want the Ukrainians striking Russian targets inside Russia with U.S. supplied equipment. You know, I disagree with that, but, you know, it's an arguable proposition. You can understand the rationale, right? Which is, you know, initially anyway, you didn't want to make this a war between, you know, Russia and the U.S. and Russia and NATO, etc. It's, you know, two years on, it's beginning to be a little threadbare, but in particular, in a period when we're not providing them with anything to speak of, except the $300 million package cobbled together when Jake Sullivan went to Ukraine last month, to publicly, you know, indicate continued unyielding American support, but apparently privately telling Zelensky, we don't like you hitting, you know, particularly these oil refineries because it's putting up the price of oil, you know, which is not great for us in an election year because it, you know, makes gas prices higher, inflation, you know, et cetera. Those kinds of cavils that apparently he expressed privately were then expressed publicly by both the Secretary of Defense, Tony Blinken, and then our ambassador to NATO, Julie Smith, who some people say is rumored to, you know, be a potential successor to our friend Tori Nuland, who was the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and a leading voice inside the administration, pushing for a tougher approach to the war and to Ukraine. And then there was testimony from Assistant Secretary for International Security Affairs, Celeste Wallander, in which she said that you know, we, the U.S., considered these targets to be, quote, civilian targets, and that the Ukrainians should hold themselves to a higher standard than the Russians, even though the Russians are, you know, hitting energy targets, as you pointed out, that the, you know, Ukrainians
Wallander, who I remember from graduate school, could use dipping into the history of World War II a little bit.
Well, look, here's the point. First of all, from a legal point of view, this is all, you know, arrant nonsense, right? Under the laws of armed conflict, these are all legitimate targets, whether it's Russian air bases from whence come bomber raids, you know, raining down these glide bombs on Ukrainian, you know, forces and in Donetsk or wherever. But also, you know, the, you know, petrochemical facilities, which are, you know, fuel the war machine, fuel the industrial complex, are, you know, obvious targets. It's also not clear that this, you know, these refineries are producing for export. You know, most of that production appears to be domestically consumed by the war machine. So kind of from a law of armed conflict point of view, this is nonsense. Oh, by the way, during the campaign against the Serbs in Kosovo back in the late 90s in the Clinton administration, we hit those kinds of targets, you know, ourselves.
From the end of 1944 until the end of the war, that was one of our top priorities, was to go after German petrochemicals, and for excellent reasons, because that's what fuels the war industry. I mean, it was a stunningly bad testimony. I mean, you know, the others were quotes, and, you know, I'm sure Julia Smith had, you know, she had her talking points that she had to deliver, but Celeste Wallander, I was truly appalled. I mean, it's,
well, so this is, you know, there's, you know, nothing to the legal argument. Strategically, as you were saying, it's an astrategic argument, and morally, it's particularly squalid to, you know, to be lecturing people who are facing a, you know, existential, you know, war, and saying, oh, don't go hit those, you know, Russian targets. Now, look, I think there's a, you know, a debate that one can have about whether the Ukrainians would be better off, because they have limited, UAVs that can, you know, penetrate deep into Russia. So they don't, it's not a, you know, a totally endless supply that they have. So I think you make an argument. Are you better off hitting the air bases? Are you better off hitting, you know, the petrochemicals? What, you know, what's the best mix of targets here? That's a legitimate discussion. But the we don't like this because it's, you know, it might raise the price of gasoline for Americans is you know, just, you know, an infuriating part of the conceit that this group seems to have, that they can somehow fine tune the level of violence, you know, from their pristine perch in Washington with a 5,000 mile screwdriver.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the central conceit. And it is particularly shameful, I think, at a time when, you know, Ukrainians are dying because we can't get our act together to supply them, you know, the kit that they absolutely need, that we have, that we understand they really need. You know, to in the middle of that, to be wagging our fingers at them is just, it's just appalling. By the way, I think, you know, one large consequence of this, which people are not focused on nearly enough, you, in the sense you got from the polls and from others, I mean, this is even more, I would say, than the prospect of a Trump presidency, really beginning to shape people's perception of the United States and how reliable the United States is as a security guarantor. And I am increasingly of the mind, and I'd really like to hear your view, that this is going to probably lead us to nuclear proliferation in Europe. I mean, if I were a Polish government official, I'm pretty sure that I'd be saying, okay, don't actually start a nuclear program now, but get all the pieces in place. Wouldn't you?
There is certainly potential for that. I think if we get a second Trump presidency, I think that will, you know, pour accelerant on this. You know, there's already been some discussion in European court, well, in Germany about, you know, should Germany rethink, you know, it's having forsworn, you know, nuclear weapons. I don't think that discussion's going anywhere right now in Germany, but it's out there. You know, President Macron has kind of alluded to the potential for a French extended deterrent. There are a lot of reasons why I think that, you know, is not likely to, you know, to eventuate in anything. So, I mean, I think what I would say is this is a discussion that has just begun, and depending on how events, you know, play out, there is a very, you know, watch this space. It's something that I think we really have to be concerned about. And of course, when we get to the, you know, to the Iran, you know, Israel piece of this, there's also, you know, an Iran piece of this. I mean, the nuclear nonproliferation regime is entering a period of time where it's, you know, going to be under greater stress than it's ever been since the treaty was signed in 1968. It's definitely worth, you know, worth, I think, beginning to worry about that problem. I don't think we're quite, my sense is we're not quite there yet with the Europeans, but I can, you know, see how we could get there. It's one reason, by the way, that, you know, Frank Miller and I have, you know, did a piece for CSBA about NATO's nuclear arrangements. I do think we ought to widen the participation of allies, you know, in the nuclear arrangements, notably the Poles. They're purchasing F-35s, which are going to be, you know, dual capable. We ought to train Polish pilots to fly, you know, nuclear missions. I would do if the Finns are willing, I would do the same with the Finns. I don't know enough about the Jas Gripen fighter that the Swedes have, about how easy that would be to make that a dual capable aircraft. But I mean, I do think that we ought to be expanding, you know, the nuclear mission to get, you know, allies sharing more broadly in it, in part to, you know, reassure them about the, you know, solidity of our commitment to the nuclear umbrella. But,
you know, the problem I've always wondered about with these kind of dual key arrangements is at the end of the day, there still are nuclear weapons and we'll still be the ones who can give a yay or nay. And I can imagine a sovereign government that's really pretty down on the credibility of American guarantees saying that's not good enough. I wanted to ask you a question, I'm sure our listeners, we're only listening on a podcast rather than on YouTube, probably can't see us, you know, shaking our fists and tearing at our thinning hair. But one of the things that has us kind of red in the face with veins bulging, is a recent article in Foreign Affairs by Samuel Charup, who just got a distinguished chair at the RAND Corporation, funded, I believe, indirectly by the Koch brothers, but you can correct me on that.
No, that's correct.
And Sergei Radchenko of Johns Hopkins University. And we were talking a little bit about that before. Maybe you could say a few words about that.
Well, this is an article about the negotiations that did take place between Ukrainian and Russian officials, some of it in Belarus, some of it in Istanbul, in the early months of the war. And the article is buttressed by apparently a lot of interviews, although given the way the article's written, very difficult to tell exactly, you know, because Foreign Affairs doesn't encourage, you know, footnoting your sources. There's a little bit of difficulty discerning exactly who they were talking to here. But the general point of the article is that these were serious negotiations. They might have succeeded. You know, unfortunately, they failed. But the implication is, you know, we could have negotiations again. In fact, you're seeing people, tweet this article out saying precisely that. And it comes from the usual quarters. It's folks like Emma Ashford, you know, and others who are part of the Koch, Cato, Quincy Institute, Responsible Statecraft Industrial Complex. And my concern is, that the article will be used to, you know, crank up American pressure on Ukraine to negotiate. But there's also another side to this that actually there's a Polish dimension to this that is got to do with PISM, who was your colleagues on the trip you just took. And maybe you could explain that to our viewers and listeners.
There was there's a long a string of tweets by Daniel Seligowski, who's one of their top Russia experts, which is very, very good, noting that some of the people they didn't talk to were the Poles, who were actually very intimately involved in this. They were providing security for the Ukrainians. And he makes a number of just very, very basic points. First, as you may recall, but you wouldn't really learn from the article, the Ukrainian team was probably poisoned. I mean, just enough to let them know to be that the Russians could touch them. Actually, Roman Abramovich was also poisoned in that. But the current defense minister, Rustam Umerov, was poisoned as well. He said, if you look at the composition of the Russian delegation, these are the people who have a track record as being the ones who hate Ukraine most and want to see it completely destroyed. And he said, of course, this comes on top of Bucha, and that, you know, hideous, hideous massacre. And his conclusion, which I think is the right one, is, you know, maybe the Russians would have been willing to accept unconditional surrender, maybe, but that was about it. And that it was a fraud. And it just, you know, there's just no limit to the credulity of Western intellectuals, I think.
It's not that the empirical evidence that they, you know, present from the interviews is wrong necessarily. It's just that it's news from nowhere without a context. And what one of the points Seligowski makes that's very telling, I think, is that, yes, the Russians were there negotiating, but it became pretty clear they were negotiating in bad faith.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I was going to say, it's the ability of particularly of intellectuals in the West to want to put a benign construction on malign behavior. And we see that, you know, I mean, maybe we can use this as an opportunity to shift to talk about the Iranian attack on Israel. So it's been astounding to me, you know, okay, here the Iranians, the Israelis take out a couple of Quds Force guys. Of course, the Iranians have been doing all kinds of awful things across the border. And they, you know, in the past, they blew up our embassy. They've tried to kill Israeli. They've attacked Israeli embassies overseas. They've blew up a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. You know, they're supporting attacks on merchant shipping. But somehow it was outrageous when the Israelis took out these Quds Force guys.
And of course, so we did that. We did that in January of 2020 with Qasem Soleimani. Right.
But then, you know, so they fire, the Iranians fire off well over 300 drones, cruise and ballistic missiles, which are thankfully almost entirely intercepted by a very interesting beret of US, UK, France, Jordanians, but mainly the Israeli defenses, not in terms of the drones, but in terms of the ballistic missiles, about half of which may have not even managed to get there. The Israelis, there's one, I think, Bedouin girl who was injured. It's a very minor damage at an Air Force base, but that's it. So, these things go in waves. So the first wave is, oh my God, the Iranians are going to do something terrible. The Iranians do it. And then everybody said, well, you know, they're really very moderate. They told us it was going to be coming. They probably knew that none of the missiles was going to get through. And so this was just a signal. And for God's sake, don't escalate, which, you know, is the refrain in of course, Ukraine as well. And it just strikes me as like a systematic kind of idiocy that besets Westerners when they look at this, because they, you know, one of the problems here is you look at one little episode. There's one episode. They fire off the salvo. None of things get through. Well, you know, part of the larger significance here is not just that they didn't get through. Okay, the Israelis were good. We were good. The technology was good. We were also lucky. The Israelis were lucky too. That doesn't mean that people will be lucky the next time. And the other thing is the Iranians, as they always do, you know, have kind of now moved the goalposts. It's now okay for them to directly attack Israel. That's kind of part of the rules of the game, which was not part of the rules of the game.
Right.
Before. And
the scale of the attack. I mean, it's not just that they can attack Israel, but with an incredibly large scale attack.
And the idea that they knew that nobody was going to get hurt, that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, it just is, in terms of an industrial accident waiting to happen, that'd be enough. But, you know, I was saying to some colleagues, we were discussing this, I said, let's remember that just the other day, Salman Rushdie published his memoir, Knife, which is about the attack on him at Chautauqua. This is actually from the stage that I'd been speaking at 2 weeks before. And they never paid for that. They were never held accountable for that. They were never held accountable for things like the attack on the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires. And above all, they weren't really held to account for the hundreds, if not thousands, of American service personnel who were killed and wounded by Iranian-designed explosively formed projectile IEDs in Iraq. And it just makes my blood boil, because we kind of give them a pass on all this, and then we kind of praise them for being moderate, or, you know, think that they're being really clever in doing this for theatrical purposes when all this other stuff is going on. But I fuss and fume.
So, well, a couple of things on this. One, on the question of what kind of warning we got, you know, John Kirby, who is the national security spokesperson for the administration, actually did a terrific job yesterday knocking all this nonsense down. I mean, he said, this is just ridiculous. It never happened. The idea that we got these warnings, I mean, some of this seems to be being propagated by the Turks and the Qataris and some others who were engaged, you know, in passing messages back and forth. I mean, he acknowledged that there were messages, you know, being passed, you know, back and forth, by the two sides, indirectly. But the idea that there was some warning and that this was designed to fail is just nonsense. Now, I mean, some of this may be retroactive spin by the Iranians to cover for the fact that this was a colossal military failure. I mean, as you point out, it appears that the ballistic missile failure rate was 50%. That either failed to launch or, you know, did not reach their target. And that, for a country that's invested an enormous amount in its missile forces as a tool of intimidation and coercion, that's actually, you know, an embarrassment. You can tell that the regime is deeply embarrassed, because there's been a huge crackdown on any kind of dissent in the last 48, that's 72 hours in Iran itself. So they are worried that this failure, may have reverberated at home in ways that are not helpful, to the health and maintenance, of the theocratic regime. So that's point one. Point two, however, is a little more complicated, which is, look, this was a great success for Israel, certainly for David Sling and Iron Dome and Arrow, the ballistic missile interception program that the Israelis have won, have run for some years. It should be noted that at least with regard to David Sling and Iron Dome, a lot of U.S. investment from the Department of Defense has gone into supporting that effort. But the other thing that's noticeable here to me anyway, and I think you kind of adverted to it, this was a important collective effort, not just of Israel, but orchestrated by General Kurilla, the very capable commander of CENTCOM, Central Command, along with not just the U.S., but with U.K., some French forces based in Jordan, but also apparently, Jordanians, Emiratis, and Saudis involved in this as well. And in that sense, I mean, this is a double hit for the Iranians, because it tells, the Sunni Arab states with whom we have been, trying to stitch together a collective shared early warning air defense system, this is kind of a proof of concept. This can work. And this can protect you from this kind of coercion, which, oh, by the way, may not be as fearsome as it looks. And in the case of the kind of weak horse, strong horse, this is a bad blow to the Iranians as well. Do you agree?
I think I agree, but only up to a point. I mean, I think, first they broke through that precedent that they can throw right. direct punches in the same way
they breached the threshold.
But by arming and assisting the Houthis, they broke another threshold, which is they can attack merchant shipping.
Right.
Anywhere that they can reach. So I think that's an issue. Also, at the end of the day, I mean, look, it's obviously a good thing. I don't want to it's not a gift horse, but a strong horse in the mouth. But still, the basic numbers suggest that at the moment, in offense versus defense, it's a mug's game in terms of the cost. Expense ratios. These are the defensive systems are extremely expensive. We've seen this in Ukraine,
right?
And so, yes, it's very good, but ultimately there's that, and then there is something that's been very disheartening for the Ukrainians in this, that everybody right. rallies around to defend the Israelis, who actually have resources and technologies that they don't have,
right?
And they get a lot of lame excuses while the Russians beat the daylights out of their power right. system and their civilian populations. And
people anonymously tell them that F-16s won't help you anyway.
Right. So in a certain sense, I think it's been demoralizing. I mean, the Ukrainians basically support the Israelis on this. And I believe the Israelis kind of quietly are supporting the Iranians too, by the way.
I want to make sure we give some credit here to folks, both in the Trump and the Biden administrations, which is the movement of Israel out of UCOM and into CENTCOM.
Yes, absolutely.
Never made any sense. Is something that, I think the U.S. government finally got right. And I think it was very important to get it right.
And by the way, I would say, your kudos to General Kurilla and to his predecessor. I would also say General McKenzie, because this was not done overnight.
Yeah.
Both Generals McKenzie and Kurilla deserve a lot of credit for the quiet diplomacy. There's another, by the way, another upside to this, which is, the Gaza War clearly didn't prevent a number of the Arab states from pitching in on this.
Yeah.
And there's a lesson.
To your point.
There's a lesson there, too.
Yeah, I agree. And to your point about the cost imposition that this allows the Iranians to execute on Israel and its allies, because the cost of defense and intercept is higher than the marginal cost of adding another, you know, Imad missile to the arsenal. It's true. I think what it highlights is the importance of investment in directed energy as a tool for defense. I mean, obviously, high-powered lasers and microwaves are going to have to be harnessed in a way that allows you to use them, you know, to take down, you know, cruise missiles, UAVs, ballistic missiles, et cetera, because that gives you a, you know, more or less a bottomless magazine with much lower cost per shot.
And that's apparently on the march, although, you know, does that stuff work in the fog?
Right.
You know, I mean, that's every, you know, I just remember from when I was running the study of the first Gulf War for the Air Force, you know, I was said, well, you know, why doesn't everybody just use laser guided bombs? You know, we've got the technology. And they say, well, yeah, except if a cloud drifts between the laser beam and the bomb that's falling, the bomb goes stupid and, you know, could go anywhere. So that didn't really occur to me. And they said, yeah, it's actually pretty common.
So, Elliot, let me ask you this. The Israelis now are in a kind of excruciating position. I mean, I think both you and I agree, although make sure, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but both of us agree that it's impossible to let this go by without Israel making some response, in part because this is an important threshold, as you said, that's been breached by the Iranians, and it can't go by without a riposte from Israel. By the same token, you know, this Western and particularly U.S., you know, fixation on escalation management and preventing escalation puts the Israelis in a difficult bind, because, of course, the defense, both because of the U.S. investment and the actual role that CENTCOM played in help orchestrating all of this, you know, could potentially be at risk depending on what happens. And this is obviously a debate. The Israeli war cabinet's in their third day of debate and discussion about how to respond to this. I mean, interestingly, by the way, there's some reports that Benny Gantz, who used to be the defense attaché here, was the chief of defense, is the head of the opposition coalition now in the war cabinet. He was also chief of defense at one point, that he was actually proposing on Saturday night that the Israelis respond immediately while the Iranian attack was going on, which has, from my point of view, had a lot to recommend it, because it would have been impossible for anybody to object at the point that Israel was under attack for them to be retaliating. And it would have obviated some of this discussion that we're having now. I don't know if it's true, but I mean, that has been reported. So what would you do if you were in the war cabinet advising Prime Minister Netanyahu? What would you tell him to do? There's been a lot of discussion about cyber attacks, attacks not in Iran, but against proxies. There's been talk of like one, you know, demonstrative strike in downtown Tehran to take out, I don't know, the IRGC headquarters, or the MOIS headquarters or something in the middle of the night, so there's no collateral damage and no civilians killed. What, you know, if even if the Israelis telegraphed that, I will tell you, and executed it in a way that, you know, minimized civilian casualties, instead of being, you know, rewarded by people saying how moderate they are and how clever they were for doing it, they would be excoriated for, you know, escalation. But never mind, put that to one side.
Yeah, and also the Israeli mindset after October 7th is, okay, fine, denounce us. I think I would probably say, first, you know, the Israelis have a long tradition of doing things and not taking credit, but maybe giving a wink. So if you remember, when you and I were in government, there was the North Korean nuclear reactor in Syria, which they blew up, and they weren't going to say, they didn't say anything about it. They wanted it that way, which suited their interests, but didn't say ours. And it, you know, it's part of this kabuki of the Middle East where bad things happen, but you don't necessarily crow about it, and everybody understands what's what, and you get on with business. I think so. That's first thought. I would probably say that should be the approach this time. I probably would not blow up an empty building. I would say, you know, to make this painful, you're going to have to kill some senior Quds Force IRGC people. That also has the benefit of weakening them. And I think I would probably opt, if there are juicy targets in Syria or Iraq or Yemen, that would be fine. But I think, you know, for the Iranians to wake up one day and there are, you know, a bunch of smoking craters where some IRGC office buildings stood, or for those things to be hit during the middle of the day, you know, I think that would be fine. I mean, probably I was always this way, but I am more willing to lean into forceful responses. I recently dug up an article of mine that I wrote a decade ago after the Russians invaded Crimea. I'll send to you after the podcast. And, you know, what I said is we're at a moment, and if we don't respond forcefully, there's going to be more and more and more. And I very explicitly drew the comparison of the 1930s, and that really does weigh on me. So this article of mine about the Iranian attack, that's how it ends, that, you know, I think we make a big mistake. It's one of the mistakes the administration is making by wanting to compartment these problems. You know, it's we got a Russia problem, we got an Iran problem, we got a China-Taiwan problem, and a North Korea problem. And my view is that's sort of the mistake that Western statesmen said, well, we've got a, you know, Mussolini in Italy, in Ethiopia problem, we have a Hitler in the Rhineland problem, we have a Japanese in the Marco Polo Bridge problem in Manchuria. And not having the lack of statesmanship to understand that actually this is part of a much larger big picture. Not that all these guys are completely in cahoots. I think the title we gave it was The Coalition of the Malevolent. It's not an axis of evils that's already been used, and I'm not sure, I think that's a bit overdone. It's not an alliance. These guys don't cooperate entirely. They have conflicting interests, and in the long term, quite conflicting interests. But what we're seeing is, you know, the bad actors are coming together, and what you do in one theater is going to affect the other. I mean, if the Iranians really suffered heavily for this, in a way that really kind of shook the regime, and we were kind of seen to be behind that, I dare say it would have a useful impression in Russia and China and North Korea. So, you know, but you may have just caught me in a particularly bloodthirsty mood. What about you?
Well, I'm going to send you in exchange an article. The first article I wrote for the Weekly Standard. The late lamented Weekly Standard, which was at Bill Kristol's behest, and it was on why we need to respond to Putin's seizure of Crimea. It just shows, you know, great minds, right?
They always have.
So, look, I think that Israelis have to, respond to this. And I think there probably has to be some response in Iran. I don't know that the response in Iran needs to be kinetic, particularly. I mean, I think a cyber attack, maybe a SCADA attack that really disables something, you know, very important, which shows the Iranians that, look, the Israelis have a lot of ways to reach out and touch them, I think would be, you know, fine, particularly if it obviated a big, you know, big fuss with the Americans. You know, Ray Take, who's been a guest on the show and my co-author periodically, and a co-author with among the three of us. Yeah. He and Ruel Gerecht had a piece in the New York Times today, which made the very important point that the more daylight that the Iranians perceive between the United States and Israel, the more they will be encouraged to take risks. And I think that's a very important, you know, point as well. I think I don't know if we've exhausted you upon your return, but we probably have run out of time. It's great to have you.
As usual, if they would only listen to us, Eric, you know?
I know. If they only let us run the zoo.
Yeah. It would be a happier zoo. It would still be a zoo, but it would be a happier zoo.
So there you have it from Zootopia. Elliot, it's great to have you back. That'll have to be it for this episode of Shield of the Republic, but we will be back next week.